podcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. Huh.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and on today's show, it's our special focus on culture and media for the fourth Friday. Here in D.C., family and friends of Sharnice Milton are marking the second anniversary of her unsolved murder. Milton was a young journalist shot and killed in Southeast D.C. 2 years ago. Now a community bookstore is being launched and named in her honor. Also, Janine Jackson, host of Counterspin, is back with us to talk about many media things, including the government's double standard for leaking so-called confidential information and double standards for coverage of the so-called war on terrorism and what innocent civilians are worthy of news coverage. And in the second half, the cell phone, tablet, and wireless technology is so ubiquitous that we have become somewhat oblivious to its dangers. But scientists and activists are sounding the alarm. You don't want to miss that discussion to stay informed and to keep you and your loved ones safe. All that is coming up. Now, our headlines from D.C. this week. President Trump made headlines because of his cozy relationship with blood-soaked regimes in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Philippines. And while out of the country, he dropped his proposed budget that human rights advocates characterize as a harsh attack on the American people. Deborah Weinstein, executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs, said that, quote, "For those who thought the budget would provide investments to create jobs, that promise is broken. Cutting trillions of dollars from needed services will slow our economy. Education cuts will make it harder for people to qualify for good jobs." She added, "The budget would massively transfer money that should be invested in all our people to a handful of millionaires and profitable corporations through multi-trillions in tax cuts that would average $50,000 for each millionaire." End quote. Now for more news about how real issues are impacting real people this week, I'm joined by our geopolitical analyst, historian, and prolific author, Gerald Horn. Gerald, of course, a big media story this week is the horrific bombing at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, that killed at least 22 people. In contrast, there's not so much media attention on the bombs the UK and the US are complicit in dropping on children in Yemen and in Libya, where the presumed bomber has roots. So what's your take today?
What's even more striking about the Manchester bombing that you just made reference to is that the mainstream press has refused adamantly to connect the dots. That is to say that these bombs, in a metaphorical, if not literal sense, that were detonated in Manchester were actually constructed in the chaos of Libya that was delivered by the ill-advised 2011 overthrow of the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi by the U.S.-led and British-led NATO forces. Strikingly, Jeremy Corbyn, who is trying to be the next British prime minister, has now pledged to drop the war on terror as the operative framework for British foreign policy. And it seems to me that he's trying to connect the dots between ill-advised British foreign policy and bombings that you saw take place in Manchester. Mm-hmm. But sadly and tragically, that kind of connection has yet to be made by mainstream politicians in the United States of America.
You know, you speaking of Corbyn, I did hear that sound clip where he was making those connections, connecting those dots. There seems to be almost a media blackout on him. I don't see much coverage about him and his campaign, which seems to be written off by the mainstream press.
You are correct, but keep in mind that the latest polls show that he is behind Prime Minister Theresa May, that is to say the Labour Party is behind the Tories, by a scant 5 percentage points. And I think that it's possible for the Labour Party to close that gap before the election, which takes place in less than 2 weeks.
Well, Since we were mentioning Libya, I don't want to fail to mention on this show that this month, 80 more of the schoolgirls kidnapped in Nigeria 3 years ago were recently returned home, and that their kidnapping of almost 300 girls spawned the, bring back our girls or bring our girls home campaign. And now, I guess what we could call the success of the kidnappers, the group Boko Haram, is connected to the same destabilization of Libya and the assassination of Gaddafi. So, what is the latest that we should know about the impact, not only in Europe, that people have been witnessing this week, but also in Africa?
Well, with regard to Africa, you are correct in suggesting a connection between the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in 2011, which leads to chaos spreading southward into Mali, which eventually trickles into northern Nigeria, which gives a boost to Boko Haram, which has been given responsibility for the kidnappings that you made reference to. But unfortunately, there was a recent report that suggested that one of the problems in confronting Boko Haram is that the Nigerian military is basically siphoning off billions that are being donated to help them fight Boko Haram for their own narrow purposes. Mm-hmm. And as long as that is the case, it seems to me that Boko Haram will receive an extended lease on life.
Well, here in the U.S., not getting much corporate media attention is a huge victory this week for voting rights. So I want you to tell us a little bit more about this week's Supreme Court decision and why it's so important.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion penned by Elena Kagan, who is a leader of the so-called liberal bloc on the high court, made a ruling with regard to the congressional district in North Carolina of former Congressional Black Caucus member Mel Watt. What happened is that the North Carolina legislature, dominated by Republicans, tried to pack in more black voters into Mel Watt's district in order to create more steadily reliable Republican, mostly white districts. Justice Kagan fundamentally said that race can be used as a factor in crafting electoral districts, but not the predominant factor. But in the wider scheme of things, I think perhaps the most important aspect of this ruling was that the most conservative justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm speaking of Justice Clarence Thomas, who of course is a black American, sided with the liberal bloc with regard to this particular opinion. I'll leave it to others to ascertain whether or not this is a straw in the wind or whether it was just a one-off on Justice Thomas's part.
Wow. And then finally in the news, Cornell Brooks was, I want to say, ousted as head of the NAACP. The board voted not to renew his contract as of next month, the end of next month. So there might be some backstory to this that you can share?
Well, what's striking about the NAACP is that they've been changing leaders more regularly than some change underwear. In recent years, there's been Ben Jealous, there's been Bruce Gorton, there's been Ben Chavis, there's been Kwesi Mfume. But I think that the board of the NAACP has refused to grasp the problem, which is that instead of changing leaders, they should change the line. What I mean is, in the late 1940s, beginning then, they began to oust from positions of influence in the NAACP socialists like W.E.B. Du Bois and others to his left. Then in the 1950s and 1960s, they began to attack black nationalists like Malcolm X. I found it quite striking that this decision of the NAACP board ousting Mr. Brooks was made on Malcolm X's birthday, May 19th. So what that means is that the NAACP has basically systematically shrunk its base. Its base has been shrunk to consisting of either churchgoers and or liberals, and leaving on the sidelines those of the left and those who happen to be black nationalists. Until that line is changed, I think we can look forward to the NAACP consistently and persistently sacking its leaders for supposedly being unable to build a militant fight-back organization that's so desperately needed in this era of resistance to Donald J. Trump.
Right, and I heard, or I read a few commentators mention what we, most of us that cover the movement, know, that the NAACP has been kind of outshined by and, you know, outworked by a series of younger, more energetic movements like Color of Change and the Movement for Black Lives and BYP 100. Just people are out there on the, you know, on the ground, on the front lines, you know, fighting for social justice. So,
well, that's correct. But once again, it's an easy enough problem to solve. Unfortunately, I think that this has a lesson for Pacifica as well. That is to say that one of the reasons that the NAACP shuns those of the left and black nationalists because they're trying to pander to and cater to their corporate donor base. Obviously, Pacifica has been able to avoid that snare thus far.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure to continue to follow these stories and speak again soon. I've been speaking with our geopolitical analyst, historian, and author, Gerald Horn. Thank you, Gerald, for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, issues of labor, affordable housing, and public safety are center stage here in the nation's capital region, just as they are around the country. The working families of Brooklyn Manor in Northeast D.C. are in the final rounds of fighting to keep their apartment homes. Chantal James has more.
Once again, the D.C. Zoning Commission has sold the people out.
Right.
They have approved a redevelopment plan that will inevitably displace hundreds of families from a community that they've lived in for decades. So we're extremely disappointed. You know, they claim that there are these quote-unquote caveats. They have not addressed the fact that the numbers don't add up. 535 units, they're replacing those with 373, restricting 200 of them for seniors only. Mm-hmm. There are many more than 173 families on the property, and they will have nowhere to go once they eliminate the family-sized units and once they eliminate the affordable units. So we're extremely disappointed, but we're unsurprised.
Is this the last step?
Absolutely not. We're just getting started.
That was one D.C. organizer, Yasmina Marabid, from the courtroom where the D.C. Zoning Commission had just decided to displace hundreds of hardworking people after less than an hour of deliberation. On Monday, dozens of residents of the Northeast D.C. housing complex known as Brooklyn Manor rallied at One Judiciary Square to appeal to the Zoning Commission once more. This was to be the evening that the commission decided the fate of the many working class families who had been calling Brooklyn Manor home for generations. To the deep disappointment of those who had come together, the Zoning Commission financial corps to blaze forks and build luxury apartments in its place. But the spirit of resistance of the residents of Brooklyn Manor could not be stifled. In their continued commitment to the cause of affordable housing for themselves and folks all across the city, young resident Mariana Richardson raised her voice shortly before the hearing in duet with longtime activist Lucy Murphy about the need for Brooklyn Manor residents of all ages to stay exactly where they are.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
When we hold together.
When we hold together.
We make ourselves strong.
We make ourselves strong.
Together we stay here.
Together we stay here.
Right where we belong.
Right where we belong.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
To find out how you can help the Brooklyn Manor residents in their continued struggle, visit onedconline.org. From Judiciary Square, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantal. And in happenings, tomorrow, May 27th, from 3 to 7 p.m., there will be a book drive and memorial cookout honoring the life of Sharnice Milton, a 27-year-old journalist who was struck and killed by a stray bullet 2 years ago while she was waiting for a bus in Southeast D.C. Her murder remains unsolved. Milton, a native of D.C., was fiercely committed to her community and wrote with passion about its people and politics for the publications The Hill Rag and East of the River. Tomorrow's event is free, and it will also feature a performance by EU and Sugar Bear. And for more information, go to weacradio.org. Also tomorrow, May 27th, the 45th anniversary of the celebration of African Liberation Day will be marked here in D.C. with a parade and march, followed by a program at Union Temple, 1225 W Street in Southeast D.C. More information is at alduhuru.org. That's alduhuru.org. And today is the last day to pre-register for the June 3rd Hope Without Boundaries 5K Run Walk at the National Harbor to benefit the organization Black and Missing, a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to bring awareness to missing persons of color, provide vital resources and tools to missing persons' families and friends, and to educate the minority community on personal safety. Proceeds from the event will go towards funding for families of the missing, flyer distribution, financial support, victim recovery, and burial assistance. Information is at hwb5k.org. That's hwb5k.org. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, for this segment, we're going to talk about how journalists, news organizations, and the role of news coverage continues to be a big story. With me for this monthly extended focus on culture and media is Janine Jackson, media critic and host of the nationally syndicated show Counterspin. Welcome back to the show, Janine.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's difficult to know where to start. A reporter for the Guardian newspaper was assaulted Wednesday by Greg Gianforte, the Republican candidate for Congress in Montana, who did not like the questions being asked him, and that, you know, he was charged with assault, actually. So, with all that happening, you know, and that's just in this country, you know, around the world, journalists are under assault and even worse. But we have to try to focus, so I want to know the stories this month from Counterspin that you would like to highlight.
Well, you know, you don't want to go too far from concern for journalists getting beat up, that's for sure. That's always going to be high on our list, and we mm-hmm. should certainly be paying attention to that. But some other stories that I've been able to do this month, well, one in particular I would love to highlight, which was from around Mother's Day, and that was to talk about National Mama's Bailout Day. I had the pleasure of speaking with a woman named Arissa Hall, who works at the National Bail Fund Network, and she was talking about a very successful action that happened around Mother's Day in which people pooled their resources around the country and got some money to get some black women who were incarcerated simply for the inability to pay bail and got them out so they could be home with their families for Mother's Day. And it was about calling attention to the really cruel and unfair bail system that we still have in this country. But I liked it so much because it also was just a human to human, you know, it's humans helping one another and also calling attention to a bigger problem. So I love to spotlight a story like that, an activism story that calls attention to a problem but shows that there are folks that are working on it and shows you ways to get involved. And National Mama's Bailout Day was a great, great example of that. I was happy to talk about it.
Yeah, that was awesome. You know, the movement for Black Lives, the people at BYP 100, this organization you spoke to.
Color of Change.
Them, yeah, exactly. I mean, they amaze me with the way that they are able to keep reminding us of the ways that the criminal justice system is not only unfair, but how it's normalized very unfair treatment of people.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think spearheaded by a woman named Mary Hooks from SONG, Southerners on New Ground, which is a fabulous activism group. And I think we often overlook the South when we're thinking about where activism is going on. And that is a mistake because there's a lot of exciting work being done, including by SONG. But yeah, she pointed out that Black people have a long history of helping one another out, you know, of buying one another's freedom, literally, and that this is part of that tradition, but that it calls attention to, you know, something that people think is maybe behind them. Or they think we have a criminal justice system that's unfair, but they don't unpack the racism involved in it. They don't recognize that, and I think many people don't actually know, that we have a lot of people, thousands and thousands of people who have not been convicted of any crime at all, who are sitting in jail, who are unable to be with their families, who are unable to go to their job simply because of the amount of cash.
Right, and they lose their job, and they lose sometimes their home or their apartment, and in some cases of these women, they lose their children. You know, and so it's, you know, yeah, just a tremendous story that I know we tried to highlight on our show, and that did get picked up
in, you know, a lot of places that don't seem to care really about those stories. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. I was very interested, and I spoke with Arissa Hall about it, and she agreed that the coverage was not as cynical or not as critical as we kind of thought or worried that it might be, that people did seem to recognize the heart at the center of the action, but then they also did seem to recognize the patent unfairness. Certainly it goes against everything that Americans like to tell themselves they are. If you say that, well, a rich man and a poor man can be in the same situation and the rich man will go free simply because he's rich, that's exactly the type of thing that Americans like to say doesn't happen here because we have the law that is an equalizer and everyone's equal before the law. Well, we know that's a joke. Mama's Bailout Day was a way of not just reminding us that that's not the case, but of showing us something that we can do about it.
Well, I wanted us to have an opportunity, if we could, to move to somewhat lighter topics. and I realize that sometimes it's hard for me to find a lighter topic, you know, but sometimes I do enjoy some things I see, but maybe, you know, they're fleeting. It's fleeting, and then I can't remember when, like, we sit down to talk. But there are two things that I thought of. That Get Out, that, you know, sleeper box office, you know, success, is on pay-per-view now. So people can see it on TV, and it's given it a whole new life for people who didn't see it in theaters, where it grossed more than $220 million, almost $230 million, and it became like the highest grossing film by a black filmmaker ever. And it's given the pay-per-view audience, it's given it a whole new life. And I just happened to be at a party recently where they had it playing. This was one of these like suburban houses that have like a home theater. And they were actually playing it there. And so I guess people hadn't seen it before. And so it had a whole new range of people to get their aha moment.
Isn't that something? I think that's wonderful. That was a real revelation for a lot of folks. Again, I was amazed, as with Mama's Bailout Day, I was amazed at the positive reaction from folks, white and black. And what I would like to see, of course, is, you know, what we never see in Hollywood, and I know we're keeping it light, but you see a film that's very successful, that's about blackness, made by black filmmakers, and you think, well, that can be successful, so maybe we'll see more like that. You know, hopefully we'll see more black filmmakers being given a shot at this.
Exactly.
When you can see how successful it can be. So I hope that apart from its just the impact of the film itself, it's an amazing film, that it will have a kind of a multiplier effect that more black filmmakers and more black films will be out there.
Right. We're going to have to wrap up our little discussion today. But I've been speaking with Janine Jackson, host of the nationally syndicated show Counterspin. Thank you for joining me, Janine.
It's always a pleasure, Esther.
We are going to now go to our final segment for today, and it's focused on the dangers of cell phone use. And this is a subject that the corporate media also does not touch, you know, with all those "Can You Hear Me Now?" commercials paying the bills for them. But last month, an Italian court was the first court in the world to recognize a causal link between the cell phone use and the brain when they awarded a telecom employee, Roberto Romeo, lifetime damages of 500 euros per month after he developed a brain tumor from 15 years of cell phone use constantly. The ruling has made international headlines, maybe not here, but internationally, as the court's expert refused to accept the telecom industry funded studies as evidence. So with me to talk about that case is right here in the nation's capital and wireless technology, is Theodora Scarrato, Education Director for the Environmental Health Trust, a scientific virtual think tank conducting cutting-edge research on environmental health. Currently, the think tank is addressing health concerns about cell phones and wireless and recommends reducing exposure to reduce risk. The trust maintains a regularly updated database of worldwide precautionary policies, and more than a dozen countries recommend reducing wireless exposure to children. Thank you for joining me today, Theodora.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, a lot of people hearing this will want to know, what is the danger and how can I protect myself?
Well, you know, going to the right to know, we really have a right to know that cell phones and wireless technology is microwave radiation, which has not been pre-market tested for long-term safety. And in Berkeley, in fact, there's a right to know ordinance that was passed informing people about the fact that cell phones emit microwaves. And there are actually a lot of ways to reduce our exposure. And, of course, in other countries, they're doing so much. France, Belgium, Israel, Cyprus. So, but here in the United States, actually, in some ways, the opposite's happening, where our right to know, just as an example, in Berkeley, the response has been to sue, stating that the industry's right to free speech is being violated by informing the public about this issue. So we're working hard to, and we have a website, Environmental Health Trust, it's ehtrust.org, where we have all kinds of ways that people can reduce exposure to cell phones and wireless.
I know I met you and your group at the Green Festival, mm-hmm. and I was really drawn to these really catchy posters, like postcards that you had, and one said, Protect the Girls, and it had a picture of a woman with like a cell phone kind of tucked into her bra. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of women have this habit, or younger people, like maybe they're going to a club, they don't want to have a purse, and they're putting that cell phone like tucked right into their bra. And that's very dangerous. Can you tell us about that? And also, I guess because we don't have a lot of time, for the male part of this, a lot of men put the cell phone in their front pocket. So why are you warning girls and boys to not do this?
Well, actually, in the phone, in the fine print in the phone, it states there should be a distance between the body and the phone. And tragically, we're finding more and more young women who are developing breast cancer, unusual breast cancers, directly underneath where the phone was when they stored it in their bra. Mm-hmm. And you can go on our website and see many stories. There's published case reports on this. In terms of men, when you put a cell phone, and women, actually, who we have ovaries, right? So when you put the cell phone in your pocket, the exposure is to that your lower abdomen, and there is research showing sperm damage and fertility impacts, DNA breaks in the sperm. Mm-hmm. So this is really, it's really a right to know issue, and we need to also call on the federal government to enact policy that protects the public.
Right. So I know there are some D.C. cases. We talked about a case in Italy, but you said there are some cases right here working their way through the courts.
Yeah, well, because all independent research is actually showing that people who've used cell phones to their head in the long term, over 10 years, have an increased risk of brain cancer. And those cases, they've started in the 90s, but now there are 13 cases that are consolidated and actually moving forward in D.C. Superior Court. So that'll be, it's been 15 years, actually, you know how court cases drag on. But I expect we'll be hearing more about that in the fall, actually.
Okay. Yeah. And real quick, because we are running out of time, and I promise we're going to have you back and we're going to do a longer segment. But quickly, two more things. What is the concern over 5G technology, and what is the so-called Internet of Things that we need to worry about?
This is really important because Washington, D.C. is one of the test cities for 5G. This is going to be a new technology with even more wireless signals that will be moving through the air. They are going to be putting up literally thousands of new cell towers, mini cell towers, on residential neighborhoods and streets to increase the Internet of Things. Is where everything's connected. Your cell phone connects to your appliances, connects to, they have wireless tampons, they have wireless, you know, everything will be connected. And this is a real concern. It's more than a concern, because we know that the frequencies that we already have in use have health impacts, and now these new frequencies will be higher millimeter frequencies, which are already used as crowd control weapons by our military.
Okay, so I want to thank Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, and our engineer, Michael Red Eagle Nacella. We love to hear from you. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows and volunteer to work on the show. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. There's a green picket sign that says On the Ground. I'm Esther Avaram. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
Hello, KBOO listeners. The time is 11:59, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. That was On the Ground that you just heard, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, with reports from Gerald Holm on the Manchester bombing, Libya, and the Supreme Court's voting rights decision. If you'd like to hear that or anything else that you heard this morning, please go online to kboo.fm/listen. As always, you'll be able to hear programming later in the day for anything you heard today or other days as well. KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast locally to Portland, Corvallis, Hood River, and everywhere in between. But what if you're too far away to listen to KBOO on the radio? Well, never fear. There are many ways to connect to KBOO, no matter where you are, by listening online. So KBOO offers two web streams that are compatible with iTunes and most media players as well. If you're on a slower connection, you'll be able to listen to our original music, news, and public affairs programs. Find out more about how you can listen to KBOO anywhere you happen to be by going to kboo.fm/listen. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Thank you.
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora. You're done north!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet, Sunday, June 11th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge in Oak Grove. The Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet is hosted by Abate of Oregon, a group that promotes motorcycle awareness,